Zach, you ready? I call to order the House Committee on Human Services.
We get sensitive about this.
Children? Settle down.
Probably means that the chair is comfortable for a change. We're too warm. You must be comfortable.
I'm just fine. I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2442.
That's going to be carried over.
I know. Oh, that's all I have to do.
Yeah, you just have to announce it will be carried over.
It'll be carried over until Friday, March 20th, right?
Yes.
Okay, and now I'm going to open up a public hearing and possible work session on SCR 4.
SCR 4 is a memorial resolution for the family of Jackson County Health and Human Services Director Hank Collins. And I was under the impression we were going to have someone here to testify from Center's office.
So shall we hold it for a few minutes?
Yes, if we can do that, we can go ahead, I guess, and proceed to the DHS hearing.
And maybe Zach could call whomever.
They were going to, yeah, let me find out what, if we want to go ahead and do. Open 2123 or open the public hearing to allow the DHS workers to speak?
That would be interesting to let them speak.
They've arranged special testimony for you this morning,
Representative. Okay, sure. Well, then if whomever is coming to speak on this one, if they come, then they'll be waiting quite a while.
Couldn't we just toss it that way?
I need to check my notes. And
could we do this last one?
It was Senator...
Does anybody know who that IQ is?
It's right here.
For who?
It's in Jackson
County. Oh, it's Bates and Buckley.
Okay.
But we could always recess the hearing that we're in the middle of.
That's true. That's a good idea. Okay, we will close the public hearing and possible work session on SCR 4 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2123.
Okay. House Bill 2123 directs the Department of Human Services to report to each regular session of the legislature on staff workload, workload efficiency, and staffing needs in the areas of child welfare, temporary assistance for needy families, nutritional assistance, and vocational rehabilitation services. We have an amendment before us that adds the areas of medical assistance and assistance to seniors and disabled persons to the reporting areas.
Great. Good morning.
Morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director for Department of Human Services, and I'd actually hope to have two workers here to talk with you this morning about workload. Thus far, we haven't seen them. Hopefully, they'll be here momentarily. I'm happy to answer any questions you have remaining on 2123 or the -1 amendments that we'd propose to add seniors and persons with disabilities into the bill.
Thank you, Jim. Well,
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Representative Maurer.
Do you understand what they mean by workload efficiencies? Or do we need to wait?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, the workload efficiency really is related to the transformation work that DHS is undertaking in looking at all of our workload processes and trying to make them more efficient. So from the department's term, for the department's view, that's clear enough. It really is literally about trying to reduce the workload through making it more efficient and reduce the need for additional staff.
Representative, if I may, on the Ways and Means Committee, we've been hearing about that, and it is very impressive. It's a total transformation in how they're looking at their jobs and how they can do it in a more efficient way, and it couldn't happen at a better time, could it, when they're going to be
agree.
Having more workers.
The goal of DHS is to make people self-sufficient, and that's almost contrary to a social worker's job because theoretically they want to work themselves out of a job. And so there can be an internal conflict at some point. But
having been a social worker, I think that's a little misleading. I would be happy when I could close a case, believe me, because there were several waiting in the wings. Yeah. Representative Cowan, I'm going to come to you after Representative Freeman.
No hurry. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go real quick. And my question is about the amendments, and the same question I asked last time. And I'm very supportive of the idea of looking for efficiencies and reporting and all those things that this does. My question is, this is not going to take people away from providing service to do reporting. I mean, that's all I want to make sure, that we can afford to do this, or there's no extra cost, or we're not limiting services so that we can do reporting.
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, absolutely correct. We're, in fact, the whole notion of this, of the transformation, is to really free up time for our workers to spend more time with clients and less time on paperwork.
Thank you.
Representative Cowan, and I see that we have Senator Bates here, and so this will be our last question, then we're going to take a break from you and get back to this, and maybe the workers will be here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm basically just refreshing my memory, and from the last discussion we had about this, a lot of the centers, if I'm remembering correctly, around the idea of, as kind of like the supermarket, when you call in an extra checker, when you have more people in the office and trying to allow people to get their applications completed in one visit instead of needing to come back from the client's end of things, but that then decreasing the workload from the staff end in terms of carrying forward some sorts of unfinished application processes and that sort of thing. Is that, it may not be the total thing, but that's what I took away from the last one. Is that a...
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, that's exactly one of the best examples of the work, and one I used last time around. It really is about relooking at how we're doing the business to improve our services.
I just want to make sure I'm remembering correctly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2123 and open up a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 4. Senator Bates, we're so happy to see you here.
I don't know.
You're welcome.
So you can report.
You're coming up to join us?
For the record, Madam Chair, Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from Southern Oregon, District 3. Thank you for hearing me this morning, and thank you for taking the time to break from your normal business to hear about Senate Concurrent Resolution 4. It's a resolution that honors a very special man in Southern Oregon, one I'm sure most of you have never heard of or even know. Hank Collins died unexpectedly from leukemia this last year. It was a particularly difficult type of leukemia. He fought as long and hard as he could, but in a very short time, he was gone from our presence. Hank was the health director in our county. Came there about 20 years ago. I'm not going to read the concurrent resolution. You can do that yourselves. I just want to tell you a few things about this man so you have an idea of why we asked the Senate to vote on this, and they did in a positive fashion, and why we brought this forward. Hank was a pretty unusual guy. He came to us from Tennessee. He's about 6'4", tall, thin, had a real nice southern drawl. I had the pleasure of working with him for many, many years in different projects. He was absolutely dedicated and cared about people who couldn't speak for themselves. He was most concerned about people in poverty, women and children especially, who couldn't speak for themselves and who needed help, whether it be issues of mental health and drug and alcohol problems or poverty. He constantly worked for these people in our county. He was always looking at new programs and new ways of doing things. He wasn't locked in the old ways of doing things. Our county was the first to integrate social services. In White City, he put up a building that brought together everything from food stamps to mental health and drug and alcohol treatment and physical medicine treatment, too, and brought that across the county. And at one point, we were the only county in the state doing that. Other parts of the state have followed that now, and other parts of the country have followed that now. probably the thing I liked about Hank the most was his personal courage. He took on some things that just weren't popular at the time he took them on. And he did it in a very respectful manner, didn't yell and scream about it. He just had that sort of calm Southern approach to things and kept steady at it and kept working at it. When it wasn't popular to have needle programs so that people wouldn't be passing hepatitis C and HIV between people, he brought that forward. In Southern Oregon, when we were struggling with Planned Parenthood and issues of reproduction for young women and talking about making Planned Parenthood and other programs available through the county, he stood up and pushed that through. Those are the kind of things that are pretty tough to do in certain parts of our state. And Hank was always there to do them, again, in a kind and respectful way. This joint resolution simply respects him. It honors him. He was an unusual person, and we're going to miss him deeply in Southern Oregon. So I would ask for your aye vote in this, and I won't take more of your time this morning.
Thank you so much, Senator. Are you open to questions?
Absolutely.
Any questions of Senator Bates?
Just a comment.
Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you for coming, Senator.
Thank you for having
me. You said that many of us might not have known him, but any of us who worked in human services for any length of time did, in fact, know Hank Collins, and I remember him with a great deal of respect as well. So.
Thank you. Those who met him and were touched by him, I think.
Absolutely.
Unusual person. A wonderful guy. He was a great guy.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Chair.
Appreciate you coming. Always
thank you
good
very
to
much.
See you. Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak about this resolution? Come on up. But anyone else? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Gina Nickel, Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I just wanted to concur with Senator Bates. I'm very thankful that you're honoring Hank Collins today. I spent quite a bit of time with him in his hospital room right before he passed away, and he was one of my 33 bosses for the last 10 years. In Jackson County, he was one of a number of people that really joined Jackson County together to do some pretty amazing programs. And so when I looked to a county that was doing mental health services well, Jackson County was right up at the top. And I just thank you for honoring him.
Thank you, Gina. Any quick questions of Gina? All right. Thank you so much for coming today. Linda Sexton wants to speak on this. Did you want to speak on this joint resolution?
A little later.
Okay. All right. Great. I'd be happy to hear from you. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on SCR4 and open a work session on SCR4.
Madam Chair, I move a Senate concurrent resolution 4 to the floor with a due pass resolution.
Representative Boone moves SCR4 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. And I think we need a carrier. So we have Representative Buckley carry this. Okay. So I'll close the work session on SCR4 and open up a public hearing on 2123. Thank you, Gina. Now she'd like to speak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Assistant Director, DHS, and it's my pleasure to present two of our frontline workers to talk to you a little bit this morning about the work that they do. I have Linda Sexton, who's a Human Service Specialist 3 from Corvallis, Self-Sufficiency, and Brandis Standridge, a case manager from our Beaverton Self-Sufficiency office.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Linda Sexton.
Linda, just pull that right over to you.
Oh,
there you go.
Okay.
Yeah. And, I want to ask people to turn off your cell phones and your Blackberries and your Blueberries and your Raspberries, and they have to be turned off completely, not just on mute. Thank you, because it affects the sound system.
Okay. My name is Linda Sexton, and I am a family resource manager in the Corvallis Office of Self-Sufficiency Programs. I appreciate your interest in hearing from us today. I'm here to let you know how things are going in the Corvallis office. As you know, Oregon, like the rest of the nation, is facing economic challenges that many of us have not seen in our lifetime. And I want to give you an idea of how these challenges are affecting us in the self-sufficiency programs. So looking at January 2008 and comparing it to January 2009, the Corvallis Self-Sufficiency Program saw a 25% increase in the need for all services. This includes cash assistance, domestic violence, daycare, etc. And then looking at February of 2008 and comparing it to February of 2009, the Corvallis Self-Sufficiency Program saw a 33% increase in the need for all services. And I would like to remind you, as the need for services has increased dramatically, our staffing numbers have not increased in the Corvallis office at all. On a bright note, I would like to add quickly that staff members in the Corvallis self-sufficiency programs have stepped up to the challenges and continue to meet the needs of Oregonians. We understand without our services, many Oregonians would not be able to eat, parents would not be able to take their children to doctors, working parents could not afford to have their children in daycare, and some victims of domestic violence would not have a means to flee from their abuser. We care about people in the community and the state, but I have to say that workers are feeling mentally and physically exhausted. We are discouraged, and we are worried about the future. The proposed 26 furlough days would be disastrous for our clients, and it would be disastrous for staff. The ground gained in the speeding up process through transformation would be lost. 26 furlough days means some victims of domestic violence may not be able to safely flee from their abuser. A sick child will wait to see a doctor, and someone will remain hungry. And we are not just talking about a couple of clients being affected by this. We are talking about large numbers of Oregonians being impacted by our doors being closed. And the public will remember the time they were in need and our doors were closed. And not only would the public suffer from the furlough days, but the 26 furlough days would mean even more state employees would have to receive food stamps in order to survive. It means they will risk losing their homes. It means many of them will be unable to go to the doctor or take their children to the doctor because they can't afford co-pays. We understand that there's a need for everyone to share in the suffering. We get that. But we need you to know that so many state employees have already been suffering. Long before the economy crumbled, many state employees were already suffering because of low wages. The proposed 26 furlough days is unreasonable. It harms our clients and it harms state employees. And so I just want you to know that this would really have a dramatic impact on all of us here in the state of Oregon, and we just need another option besides the 26 furlough days. It's too excessive. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. You did an excellent job.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Excuse me. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee and Madam Tomei, Chair Tomei. My name is Brenda Standridge, and I am a TANF case manager and domestic violence point person for the Beaverton Self-Sufficiency Office. I've worked for the state of Oregon for 2 years, and I have 10 years' experience in domestic violence, child welfare, and other social service and advocacy programs. I am honored and humbled to provide testimony before you today and to represent my union, my co-workers, and most importantly, the thousands of Oregonians that we serve. The level of crisis I am seeing in families right now is unparalleled to anything I have seen before. What I am seeing is a tremendous gap between the haves and the have-nots, who are now equated in their desperation and their fear, and who sit into my office working so diligently to keep their composure while they describe to me the level of woe in their family. Many of them have never seen the welfare office, and families that have received our services previously, I'm seeing, are now finding fewer jobs, are not keeping jobs as long because of their work experience, because of their service-based experience. Their jobs are going quicker, and they're finding terminations quickly. I recently did two intakes, and the parallels to them were incredible. I had a family who had a $600,000 home, a $290,000 rental home. He was self-employed. His last quarter on wage was in 4 of 07, making $30,000 per quarter. They had run through their savings. They had run through their children's college accounts. Their rental home had been repossessed. They had maxed out their credit cards. They had done everything they could before coming into my office and seeing me for welfare. I was able to give them food stamp benefits immediately, and the man who was self-employed teared up and told me that he would pay this back. It would only be for a few months. He was sure his job would come back together. He was self-employed as a developer. He saw, and the people in my area, Washington County, many of self-employed, they were self-employed in the real estate, developing industry, home business industry, saw the recession long before we became aware of the impact and the tremendous fold that this was taking for us. I gave them their EBT card and explained to them how they could use it. I gave them their medical benefits. They had a TANF application and were over income because she was now cleaning houses for $700 a month, which put their family over the dollars. They're losing their home. With the clients that I'm seeing of this nature, the intakes take longer because they've never been in an office. They don't know how it works. They're afraid that if they take something, they have to pay it back. They have a lot of questions, and one of the biggest questions is, how do I use my food stamps so nobody knows I'm on welfare? And so I have to be very gentle with them, and I have to work with them on a much more emotional level than I had worked with clients previously in the past coming in for self-sufficiency services. The other realm of clients I'm seeing are clients who have used our services off and on or maybe continuously in the past, who are getting fired from their jobs for much less reasons than one would normally think would be an issue. They're being terminated for missing a day of work because their child is sick. They're being terminated for coming in late two or three times in the same month, where they have the same work history with that same employer for more than a year. So these would be issues that I would think would have come up earlier when that employee was a new person. The other issue I face is, as a domestic violence provider, I'm the DV point person in my office. I'd like to share with you the story of a woman that I recently served. She walked into the office and walked in with her two children after walking more than a mile because we were the closest office. As the DV point person, I was popped up from the front and went out to see her right away, dropping everything. I took her back and conducted my intake with her. She, of course, relayed to me stories of physical, sexual, emotional, mental, financial abuse, and isolation. She had fled the home, and that meant having no one because he'd isolated her. She had one friend, and he had been calling that friend daily. Have you seen her? Have you seen her? Have you seen her? Because the office was open that day and not closed, I was able to book her plane tickets for the next day to relocate to another state. So she was able to be safe one more 24-hour period. And I wonder, had she walked to the office that day and found us closed, would she have tried again? If she had walked to the office that day and he had found her, knowing that she was trying to seek help and leave him, what would have happened to her and her children? The state of Oregon is one of the few states that provides domestic violence assistance and intervention services. And I think with our current increase in services and our sudden service process as well, I think closing the office for even one day takes away all the ground we have gained in working this new sudden service system. And it will mean that one person, one victim of domestic violence, may not get help. And she may die, or her children may witness further abuse, or her children may be injured because there was nowhere to go for that time. The proposed furlough days and office closures that directly counteract the rapid process implementation for sudden services, which came to account through the McKinley studies that the state paid for. The Beaverton office did 799 intakes in the month of February, implementing this new process. Our normal intakes ran between 415 and 420-25, a huge jump. While the numbers are a little bit skewed because we had to quickly get all the applications and all the appointments out at the same time, we are seeing a tremendous increase, and we don't believe that we'll be far off of 600 this month. DHS employees, of course, we all know are working harder. I can't imagine your jobs, and I respect the amount of work and time and effort and the diligence that you put into serving each Oregonian. Each Oregonian that I see is in crisis, and I am the immediate stop when they are in that crisis. Mandatory furlough days, loss of paid holidays, loss of step increases, and loss of COLAs will also personally affect employees. As a DHS employee, absolute professionalism is our daily goal with every client that we meet. However, it will be difficult to give each client that 110% every day at every intake when we're looking for a second job and when we're worried how we're going to make it. The last story I'd like to tell you is a brief story about a single mom with two children. She works full-time, and she accrued $30,000 in student loans. Her rent is $845 a month, too much for her, but a safe neighborhood for her children. The water bill is another $130, and both are due the first of each month. She bought a car but turned it back into the bank during the gas hike because she couldn't afford the payment, and she couldn't afford to keep insurance and gas in the car. She knew when she started college that she wanted to work in social services and wanted a job that was 9 to 5 with paid holidays because it allowed her to cut down on daycare costs with her children when they were out of school. She has to budget new shoes by not paying a bill in full, and there's not enough money to get through the end of the month. She has no credit cards and no savings for an emergency. She can't pay her student loans, emergency room bills, or send her kids to camp with their friends. She will never own a home, and she needs a car. She's scared to death what losing over $1,500 a year, a 4.8% decrease to her pay, will mean. She is even more scared to think that in addition to losing what is to her a massive amount of money, she will have to start paying for her health care on top of an income loss. She is scared for her friends and her mom, who all work for the state, who are all in the same situation. She worries about her families that may go hungry with the work that she does, and worries about them being evicted while being waiting to see somebody because the office was closed and the work is that much farther behind. She wonders if a victim and her child will be seriously injured or killed, waiting for the office to open the next day. She and her coworkers share the same scenarios, both personal and professional, in the break room in between appointments. Then she puts on her brave face. She puts her feelings and anxieties aside. She gets the next application and calls the next name, and she hopes that it won't be her name in the next few months being called for an intake. As you consider removing step and COLA increases, implementing mandatory furlough days, and other means to save money in the current financial crisis, I would hope that you consider the number of families that are currently seeking services from the outside and how that number will increase exponentially with families from the inside. I hope you consider that the average self-sufficiency worker, the HSS-1, the HSS-3, and the case managers make about $25,000 to $35,000 a year. Many of us are single parents, and many of us are the only income for our homes. I know that you will consider our Oregon families who need our services, and I pray that the decision that you make will be for a more balanced budget and that the decisions are fair across the board. Thank you so much for hearing me today, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you for coming today and sharing your story with us. Any questions?
Sure.
Yes.
We have maybe a couple of questions. Sure. One, just the first one on the salary range. That's just kind of typical in your office or both of your offices for the pay that the employees have. There may be some. Is that a starting and an ending
range?
I'm
in the Portland, so I'm paid by Portland scale. A starting HSS3 makes $23.88 per year. That was with the new steps that came through, the new COLA that came through in November. I am a brand new case manager. I've been with the state 2 years. I'm starting out at $26.95. That was with the new wages that came through in November. When I
$26.95
is my salary.
Or $26,095 a year.
No, per month. Okay. $2,695 is my gross salary.
Thank you.
And an HSS1 makes, I want to say, $2,098. Around there. It's very low. It's very low comparatively to other people's incomes, although higher in other parts of the state. The Portland metro area is paid higher because of the cost of living.
And a follow-up on the vocational rehabilitation services that you provide. Can you kind of describe what services those are, and are those plugged into the normal WorkSource Oregon infrastructure?
I don't provide vocational rehabilitation services.
Who does the TANF?
I do TANF. So you're talking about the jobs program, the WorkSource program for TANF clients?
I'm sorry, I was reading off of the page here, vocational rehab. So I was trying to just nail down what are the jobs helps that you provide? Where do you direct people?
We put them into our jobs classes, and the jobs classes are actually run in our area through Portland Community College. It's the STEPS team through PCC, and they work with them daily on the computer to help them and support them to get a job. We lost a lot of our programs. We have parents who want to go to school, but we're not able to provide that because it's no longer a recognized activity to receive the federal dollars for TANF. So they are doing jobs, which is just no barriers to employment. You need to go find a job, you know, with that support. They're doing jobs plus, which means that they have some barriers to employment, and they need a little bit of work simulation. And then we have a placement team where we actually take somebody. Maybe they're a daycare worker, and that's what their experience is. We take somebody, we find a job that will support them, work with us to help pay them their wages for the first 6 months, and we place them there. And when that happens, they lose their food stamps, they lose their TANF, the cases don't close, and then they try to work and get on with that employer.
Okay. I wanted to know if it was STEPS or exactly what program.
STEPS, right.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Cowan and then Representative Denbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the staffing challenges and the concerns that you have, which are certainly financial considerations that this legislative body will be taking up. The bill that we're looking at today has to do with some of the changes in the agency and the methodologies. And both of you mentioned, Linda, I think you mentioned the transformation effort and Brenda, you talked about briefly or referred to the rapid process intake, I think. So if each of you could just briefly sort of describe to us what the changes in the way you process people have been as those projects have kind of been implemented, I think that would be helpful information for us.
Okay. So in the Corvallis office, with this change, rapid process improvement is what it's called, we have two whiteboards that are up at the front where our support staff basically, when a person comes in to apply for services, so they're given their application, they bring it in, they have the choice, the client has the choice if they want to be seen, then we have our staff members' names on the board, and you look for the client or the staff member who's available. And so let's say the first person on the board is available. You put a little mark there, and then that person is seen within 30 minutes. And what this process basically has done, in our office, we were doing 4 intakes a day, 4 days a week. With this new process, which it's really complicated in the beginning. It's hard to get your mind around. But because you have spaces, you're allowed so much time. If somebody comes in with no income and they're applying for food stamps, the worker has 45 minutes from start to finish to get the client in there to do all of the steps and either have a decision with that they're going to get their benefits or appended. And so now we do 6 to 7, maybe 8, 9 intakes a day per worker, 5 days a week. So that means we've gone from 16 a week average to per worker to 30, 35, 40 per week per worker. And so the goal is to have people rather than although the Corvallis branch has been pretty good, some places clients were waiting for a very long periods of time to get their benefits because there were not enough staff members, too many clients. And by this process, it's allowing us to sort of speed up the process so that people aren't left waiting, that they can either get them that day or the next day. So if somebody doesn't want to wait for 30 minutes, they can choose to be assigned a spot the following day. Does that answer? I'm sorry, does that answer your question?
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Sure, follow-up.
I guess just the question in my mind, if somebody comes in to be seen, why would they not choose to be seen that same day?
Because sometimes they have to go to work. We deal with working families who have to be to work.
Okay, so they could schedule an appointment
exactly
at a different time. Okay, thank you. I understand.
Okay.
Just trying to get my head around it.
Yeah.
Representative Deborah, before you ask your question, I'm going to follow up a little bit on this. So how has the process changed? I mean, that just seems miraculous, going from 4 a day.
So part of it is that, one, they've shortened our narrative process. There's a template is what it's called, where we, when a person comes in, there's certain facts. You know, we have to meet all the federal requirements, and so we would narrate everything on the case so that people could go back and look at it, that sort of thing. We've reduced that just the way that they've structured the board so that each worker's time is pretty much controlled throughout the day by the person who is running the board. And we used to have a protected day so that workers could, do their paperwork. That's been taken away. And honestly, there are some concerns with this process because how fast can you go?
Right.
That is a huge concern for people. We were already really busy. It's not like we weren't doing a lot with doing 16 intakes a day. But what has helped some is the shortened intakes because of the shortened narratives. That's been cut. The original one was so insanely long and repetitive, so that's helped some.
And the agency shortened that?
Yes, there was committees that met and figured out ways to do the whole rapid process improvement, and so they came up with the idea of the board and these little color-coded pieces, and it just, you're continuing, it's all day long, you're just boom, 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 and the goal is to get people served, especially with the crisis that we're experiencing with so many people in need of services, and without the ability to hire new staff, how can we get people through and get them what they need? So it is, it's stepped up a lot, and, obviously there's the good side of it, and there's the side that how long can we do this, and because it's really overwhelming and difficult, but yet we also understand that people who have never had to have services before don't know how they're going to feed their kids, and people are desperate.
And as I recall, I'm not sure if we heard it here or if I heard it in the Ways and Means Committee, but people were having to wait weeks before they could see somebody when they needed services today.
Right.
In the Beaverton office, we were scheduling, 2-3 weeks out, We weren't able to keep with the expedited, which is mandatory within 7 days. And so the rapid process that came through, we've nicknamed it sudden death. Sorry for the pun. So people come in, they just get seen, and the board just rotates. So whenever there's an empty space, people get seen. We were working on about a 38% no-show rate for appointments. Right. So now we've come through, and it's working really well for the clients. It's much harder on us in the respect that you are just boom, 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 boom all day. So we're seeing anywhere between 12 and 15 intakes per day per person, depending on the programs. And we have six HSS3s in my office.
And HS3
is a food stamp medical daycare kind of the starting out worker, and HSS1 kind of just does applications, maybe peruses for eligibility, and HSS3 actually starts processing those initial programs. A case manager, a TANF case manager, is specific with cash and all the other programs combined, and we are not seeing that. Our rapid process has not occurred at this point. In the branch that I work at, there are two pre-TANF case managers, myself and Julie Cherney. We see all the intakes. Anybody applying for cash comes to Julie and I. We are doing about five intakes per day each day of the week. And we get them all screened. We get them all initially benefited. We get the cases pulled over and reserted and readjusted and whatever needs to happen. We get them through the holistic assessment. We get them through the initial signing of their PDP, their personal development plan, and then they go to the ongoing case manager. At this point in time, we are working two ongoing case managers and two pre-TANF team members. One of our ongoing case managers has now been housed with all the undocumented persons and all the people who are not required, the SSI people, to work the jobs program. She now has 352 cases. That is her load. So we're only able to transfer the ongoing cases to two case managers who are able to take them.
Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Linda and Brenda, first of all, I want to really thank you for coming and giving such articulate testimony and just for the work that you do every day. And you, to your union, for giving you a voice, helping you to find your voice. I'd like to follow up on the, you know, the potential challenges and problems that, you know, I think, you know, Linda, you were wondering how long can we keep this up, and you mentioned the challenge of the furloughs, but then also, you know, there's just the challenge of positions not being filled through attrition or federal money not coming through to fund positions. I know the STEPS program at PCC has been kind of hammered over the last year. And just the challenge of going through this transformation process at the same time that you're, you know, under-resourced as far as staff goes. And, you know, I'm wondering, first of all, just how that reality gets into the conversation about the ongoing transformation changes. And then, Jim, probably more directly to you, how that gets factored into the reports that are going to come out, which are, you know, the subject of the bill. The report is going to talk about efficiencies that are happening, but is it also going to be talking about the sort of downsides or the challenges that are being created through the transformation process?
Go ahead.
I don't think I quite understood exactly what you're asking me for.
Well, is there, you know, as you're going through the ongoing transformation of the transformation process, you know, the deployment of it, and, you know, I assume that there's some ongoing assessment, you know, how is it working, what is changing, and a lot of that is going to go into the regular reports. And, you know, I'm just wondering, are the reports just going to be, these are the numbers that we have served in 2009 as opposed to 2008, or, you know, will there also be, you know, a more qualitative kind of component to it, you know, about, you know, how is it improved, but also what perhaps negatives there are.
Madam Chair, Representative Denbro, what we're seeing now is, I think these two workers have described it very well. It's it is overwhelming in many respects. Based on the workload model that we have, well, in self-sufficiency, we're somewhere between 50% and 60% staffed in terms of the actual workload. So the transformation process really comes on top of that, and indeed the transformation process itself requires some work, the rapid process improvements, the implementation of the intake model. That's on the one hand generated additional work, but additionally, as you've seen, it also has improved the process substantially. What we're I'm very hopeful about the transformation process. I really don't think that ultimately the transformation process is going to close a 50% gap in staffing. I think what it's doing us now is it's helping us keep up with the very high level of demand that we're seeing out there, but it is fatiguing at the same time. I think what I believe you'll be seeing in the reports really is about what's the overall workload, what things like the intake rollout have we done to try and reduce that workload. You heard about the shortened narrative template, another efficiency. But I think to give you a fair picture, we also need to talk about, you know, what are the issues. Just change generally is difficult for folks, and that produces its own anxiety, you know, on top of other things that folks are facing, the uncertainty, et cetera. I think it's a great story. I don't think it's all rosy, and I think we have to tell both sides of it.
I think one of the things that I'm seeing, we are able to make people happier. I'm getting less calls from the governor's advocacy office that sometimes had to wait. That always makes me happy. So, you know, we are seeing those people suddenly, which is meeting the increased need. Where I see the downsides just in this initial transformation point is because you are back to back to back to back all day, then your pending items stack up 2-3 weeks out on your desk.
And tell us what pending items means.
So if you were to come in for services, and medical was one of them, and I needed you to provide birth certificates, and I needed you to provide your last, you know, your last paycheck from the job that you were terminated from, and you didn't have them at the intake, I have to pend you for them. They would be required items. So then the client brings that back, and that gets put in my mailbox. But I'm seeing clients back to back to back to back to back. So I don't have a lot of time to run through my pending items. There isn't a lot of time to return phone calls. We have, you know, a next business day phone call return, and in actuality, we're going 2 to 3 days. We're getting back to the crises. On my side of the world, if a victim of domestic violence walks in, our clients are becoming more complex with mental health issues and disability issues and those types of things, I'm working harder, more integral cases. So some things are falling off. The new narration system is fabulous. I previously would have typed for an all-program eligibility, TANF, food stamps, medical, child care, and or domestic violence. It would have printed out anywhere between 8, 12 pages. I'm now getting it down to 2. Because we're not supposed to be typing anything that you cannot find in the case file or online. I don't know how the reviewers think about that, because they just be able to look things up on a previous template. So that has allowed me to work quicker. I'm not having stacks of cases build up so I can get tracks done, because in the meantime I've had to answer phone calls and do other things.
Thank you. Let's see. I have Representative Freeman. And then Representative Van Orman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to make a comment, and then I do have a question. And first, I want to thank you for the work you do it's got to be very tough work, and clearly you're caring and giving people to do this work. I want to offer you a perspective from a person that lives in a county and represents part of a county that has a 16.5% unemployment rate that's rising. Having more work than you can do ahead of you is not always a bad thing. We have many people that would love to have that problem, and I do know it's a problem, but it's not the worst problem to have. So maybe take a little comfort in that there is a demand for what you do, and even though it's a larger demand than you can fill, it's not all bad. My question is back to the reporting. What this bill does is it asks for a report. Do you, as the people that are doing the work, feel like you're going to have to take extra time for this reporting instead of provide the service?
The reporting that comes with the legislation.
Right. That's what we're really talking about today.
Well, I know in our office, what we do at the end of the week, we have a sheet basically that has us list everything that we have at our desk. We have various types of forms. And so I don't think it's a significant amount of time that we have to spend, but there is a counting of how many. So when somebody's reapplying for food stamps or medical or whatever, there's a certain application. So we go through and we count how many of those do we have, how many times have we pended, which is we needed more information. So we go through and count how many of those are in our box. And so at the end of the week, every Friday, we go through and count to see how many, so that our manager, she gathers that from all of us, and then she turns that into her supervisor, who then reports it, so that someone is keeping track of my role in our office. The employees, I mean, we have a really small role in the actual counting part, so we don't keep track of the big numbers.
Thank you. I mean, I would just agree with her.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you. As long as they were talking about the business that they do, one of the questions I have is relative to the ERDC. And when
and tell us what ERDC is.
Employment-related daycare.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And so when you have a client who loses their job, I know that in Hood River County, the potential for them to get another job is pretty minimal. So, and it eventually is going to affect the child care provider, because they're going to be losing that business. So one of the questions I have is, are you experiencing the same thing in other counties, that they lose their job, there's nothing to do, so then are they automatically eligible for other services?
I would say that they're not. We're seeing a tremendous decrease in the employment-related daycare application process because people have lost their jobs. We're closing more cases than we're putting them on. They are not then eligible for other programs. In my area, there is no program for a mom to put her three-year-old child in daycare to go look for work unless she's eligible for cash assistance. But to be eligible for cash assistance, there not only has to be an income guideline that they have to meet, which is very low, $499 for a family of two. There also has to be deprivation. So you may have no money this month, and you may have no job this month, but the father of your child comes and sees your children 3 or 4 days a week because you guys have worked it out together and you're still friends. You're not eligible for cash assistance. There's no deprivation for the children, so there's nothing I can do for you.
Thank you.
Right. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. First, a comment. Accountability costs money. And I think that's what Representative Freeman is getting at, that, accountability can create efficiencies, and make people responsible, but there's a cost to it, and just no doubt. But the real question I have is, how do you deal with good ideas in your office? These aha moments, if we just did this, then life would be just a little bit better.
Well, I know in our office we are, continuously brainstorming, or if somebody has an idea, we communicate a lot just in groups. I mean, we don't have to call meetings. We can just share ideas. And then, if it seems like it's really something that's a good idea and working, we'll share that with our supervisor, who then will share it with the powers that be. So we have a lot of discussion. When I say a lot, I don't mean excessive, just like, oh, I did this today and I thought this really worked well, and then somebody else might try that and go from there.
Follow up. So do you feel like your coworkers appear to be cooperative? What about the supervisors and then their supervisors? Do you see any of your good ideas translating to changes up the line?
I don't.
I don't either.
I think with each county it runs a little differently. My supervisor, Tammy Brooks, is very facilitative of allowing us to share ideas. I think, though, when you're sharing ideas from a caseload perspective, because we're housed differently, the threes are on one side of the building, the TANF case managers on the other side of the building, support staff and other staff kind of in the middle. So when you're talking about an idea, little changes that would affect this side or that side are implemented rather quickly, and everybody can give it a try. When you're talking about an overall change that affects the branch or the intake process, that does not get met very well, and most of the times we never hear about it again because Tammy has to report to Robin Schultz, and Robin Schultz reports to, it just goes on and on and on. And, you know, it's a difficult process, and it's difficult for clients. When you recreate what they're used to, they panic, and they are, and a lot of anxiety about, well, what does that mean for their benefits? That's the first place that they go. So it's very difficult to make changes without causing more chaos.
Plus,
one last question. How many layers are there in management above you? You alluded to four, and...
I don't know. It could go on and on and on. For my branch, we have two lead workers. We have our CRC, Jewel Kallstrom. We have our lead worker, Rashawn.
You don't have to put names to it.
Oh, so. I'm sorry. It goes to my next two, which are the ops managers in my office. They report to the District 16, and then she reports to, I think she reports to you, doesn't she? I don't know. She reports to somebody higher than her. That's what I'm aware of.
Madam Chair, Representative Marr.
From the worker level, the worker has a supervisor or operations manager, which is what they're called in self-sufficiency. Then there's a program manager for self-sufficiency that supervises the various operations managers. The program manager reports to a district manager. We have 16 districts across the state. The district managers report to me.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This kind of reminds me of how we operate here. It's a lot of pandemonium, a lot of chaos, everything at once, and then you'll have a very tightly scheduled day and two people don't show for appointments, so you have to quickly fill those 15 minutes each with something. So I guess my question is would it be possible, and Representative Maurer started to get at it a little bit with the creativity and idea mode. In a land use system, we have in what we call fast track. And these are people who come in and they just want to do this one project, so they're routed over here, and they go to this person who then can fast track them through the process. And I was trying to decide if that might be useful for your process, because you don't know who's going to be coming in the door. When they come in, you don't know what they're going to say, what they need. But there might be someone who needs a little bit of help, medium help, a lot of help. And maybe like in any emergency situation, you triage and you say, okay, well, we don't want to talk about black tags on the toes, but you might say, if you have a poster or whatever, or someone who they first contact, what do you need? And they can say, I just need a little help with food stamps, or I need a little cash. I'm between jobs. I've got an interview coming up. I'm working now, whatever. And then they go into this shoot, basically. And is that something that would be useful to you? And then the second part of it is, I don't know what your support staff system process is, but in our situation here, we have assigned support staff. So if I know you don't each have an assistant or a secretary, but if you have six of them or three of them, are they assigned to a group of the same people so they know your style and what you do and that can facilitate the workload?
Representative Bunis, I hope that when you visit your DHS office, you can ask those
same questions.
That's great.
Well, with the rapid process improvement that has happened, I mean, support staff is assigned each day. Somebody basically is controlling the board, and really that has taken on a whole new life of its own. That is their job for the day, and that's the goal. Because there's too few of workers, we can't just specialize, for lack of a better word. So if somebody comes in for food stamps only, they might see me, but they might see my coworker or another coworker. So we can't specialize, so to speak. We do it all. And so we're just allowed a certain amount of time for the various. So if you need three services, it should take probably longer than if you need one program. So that's how we try to kind of just the time factor, but we don't have, it's a small, relatively small office, so we can't have just this person who sees these people or just this person. Plus, if they're out sick, the worker is out sick, then that would leave the group of, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, you can't be seen today because this person does this and she or he's not here. So I think that's what the rapid process is trying to sort of do.
Okay.
And it's it's new. It's not even been a month in process in our office. So
I think we have to be careful, too, that it is, I think, taking over that specialized. On any given day, we run on about a 35% to 40% no-show rate. You know, somebody calls in sick, somebody's having a baby, somebody fell down and broke their leg, whatever. So we've got to keep it rolling and keep that going. And if we tell a client, or a customer, I call them, if we tell a customer, you know, what is your greatest need? What can we see first? Then we have 4, 5, 6, 7 sets of hands processing and or touching the same application. Because they want their food stamps today, they want it this minute, and they need it. So if they have a cash medical food stamp app, they'll say, okay, I'll take food stamps today, and I'll come back for my appointment. Then what you have is two workers who may have gotten two different stories as to deprivation, income, that type of thing, and now we have conflicting. Or applications get lost when you have so many hands touching the same application. So we take a look at it based on what are they applying for, how many programs are they applying for, and then that's who they should see.
Let's see, we have Representative Dimbro again, and then Representative Cowan, and then Representative Van Orman. And I think we should probably move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of a technical question. When you're doing the reporting, is a case a case a case, or, you know, as Brenda, you were talking about the situation of someone who is new to the system, really requires more time, you're going to spend a lot of time with them, or, you know, there might be someone who needs a number of different services, and you're dealing with them on a number of different services. How does that person get counted? Is that person just counted as one, or do you put a kind of qualitative, you know, like this is a level 3 of difficulty as opposed to this? You know, I'm wondering if it's just being done, a case is a case is a case, if that really is giving you a clear picture of what's going on.
I think it is done a case is a case is a case.
Yes.
And then depending on what it is that they apply for determines the amount of time. But a cash case where you're determining deprivation, where you're determining income, is the income expected to continue, all of those things, takes much longer than somebody coming in for food stamp benefits. The other thing is a domestic violence intake, which can be in conjunction with the application of 3 or 4 other applied for programs, can take 2 hours, 3 hours on some of them. Sometimes they take 45 minutes. And so when you throw in a domestic violence intake on top of that, and you're working with crisis intervention and safety planning and maybe child welfare or adult protection or other issues, then you're working on a much longer, much larger scale.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Denbrough, the measurement system, the workload measurement system that we have put into place really gets us away from the caseload-based staffing model, which has been used for years. It says for one TANF, or for 90 TANF cases, you would earn one worker. The workload model actually looks at the various components that people work on, measures how long those take, and derives the workload from that.
Great.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been interesting questions that have been raised here, and initially I had some thoughts about I don't understand really why we need a statute to tell you to bring us a report, but maybe as a result of some of the questions that have been raised, it will be interesting to see what that report is. And one of the thoughts based on some of the questions of Representative Maurer that I had that I guess what I would just like you to include as you're doing your reporting is a description of some of the supervisory, of all of the supervisory levels and management levels and what those jobs entail as well. Because I really do think that that's a confusion, both from the part, from the perspective of the worker and the perspective of those of us who sit here and try to make decisions when we really don't have a clue what's going on in many of the agencies. But I do have my appointment scheduled, Madam Chair.
That's great. other people are, too.
I don't want to see an organizational chart. I'd like to see some better description of what those boxes on the organizational chart, what those workloads entail for management-level people as well, because I really think that that would be helpful as we look through the whole thing. So that's my request of you as part of this report.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Van Orman.
Well, I had a question, and Representative Cowan has raised another one.
So we're done.
thank you. I do want to thank you for putting a face on the numbers, because we all hear this, and your reports have been very good because they really identify what we're really talking about. But my question is that I have the impression that we're already collecting the data. This bill is simply a matter of having you report to us your data. Is that a correct impression?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, that's correct. One of the things that the transformation process requires is that we know precisely what's happening, that we measure things. So irrespective of a report that we'll give to the legislative body, we still need to collect that information to make the best management decisions we can and improve processes as best we can. The report really is just another step on top of that central office will be taking to assemble this information, answer the questions folks have about how we do our work and what kind of improvements we've made and what the remaining work is.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And not seeing any more questions, I hope, I am going to... And thank you so much for coming today. We really appreciate it. As Representative Van Orman said, to put a face on people who are doing this work currently and seeing the caseload rise and people doing the best job they can under difficult circumstances, it really is helpful for us to know what's going on. So thank you so much for coming. So I'm going
thank
to be
you.
Closing the public hearings, hearing on House Bill 2123 and opening up a work session on. Could you stay here? Just in case we've got any questions during the work session, we'll let you ladies go. Thank you. Colleagues, the department asked for this. I think a lot of you know, this is my ninth year being on Human Services, and I think Representative Boone has been on Human Services a long time, too. This is the first time I've heard in depth what this agency does. And first time we've had a face on people who are doing this work every day. So I think it's wonderful that the department is asking for this, that we have this report every year. I think Representative Olson asked me before, well, why couldn't we just do this? Well, we may not be on this committee in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, and I think it's important that we be able to get this information. This is a huge department. A lot of money goes to the Department of Human Services. We need to know how it's spent and feel secure that it's spent well. So I think I really support this bill, and I'm willing to hear any discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, I I hear what you're saying, and I'm going to agree with you on that. I struggle still from my background, the need for legislation to direct an agency. I realize that your agency, Jim, is using that as a mechanism to fulfill your strategic plan on where you're wanting to get. But I just think internally you should always constantly be working at your efficiencies, that you should always be developing outcomes to be able to share with us here specifically. I clearly understand your position being in Ways and Means, nice it's to have this additional information there, but we should always be improving our services at the same time. I'm going to support House Bill 2123. That's not my style. I'm trying to get my hands wrapped around that thing.
I guess I need a motion, don't you, to do the discussion?
You do.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the -1 amendments into House District, House Bill 2123.
Representative Olson moves. Had we already accepted the amendment?
No.
Okay. Adopt the -1 amendment to House Bill 2123. Any discussion? Any disapproval of that? Then that amendment is accepted. Representative Olson.
Additionally, then, Madam Chair, I move that we move House Bill 2123 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2123 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Now, any further discussion? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too appreciate having people who are out on the front lines come in and let us know how what we do at this level translates to what they do at their level. And we're the ones getting the calls as well as I can't remember her name, the woman who sat next to you, said when she gets the calls from the governor's advocacy office, we get them too from our clients or our constituents. And so it's nice to be able to say, well, I know personally that they're working hard to do. They have a new system in place. It's only been working now for a month, so, cool your jets here. Things might become better or whatever. But I'm looking forward to going out to two of my offices, both in Tillamook and Astoria, on Monday. And I have appointments with them to meet people. The only problem is I have very short time because it's so far between them to drive. Mm-hmm. So, and I had to make it between, a certain hours, et cetera. So, but they accommodated my schedule, and I was a little embarrassed because I wanted to have them choose the time, what was easiest for them. But they said, no, when can you be here? This is whatever you can do, we'll work around it. And actually one of the persons up in supervisory position is going to meet me and follow me and be at both locations. So I'm looking forward to that, meeting people who work with my constituents. So that it's just really helpful with such a large agency to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oftentimes we approve a piece of legislation like this, and it just says report back to the legislature. And those reports come in a wide range of often unusable pieces. Mm-hmm. And I hear you say all the time to people that testify, if you could give us something with bullet points and easily readable, something that we can actually get through in one evening.
Mm-hmm.
I got a report from a commission yesterday, and very nice piece, but I quite frankly would have been embarrassed because those things probably cost around, I've done a lot of printing in my life, they were probably $3.50 to $4 easily per copy, depending on how many they made, possibly even as much as $8 per copy. And I don't think that's what we need.
Yeah.
We just want good information and not something that thick. So that we,
so we
can
want
actually
DHS to hear that too.
Mickey's taking notes back.
Yeah.
Less than a dollar.
Because I honestly try to read those reports.
Right.
But with that much reading every day of the week that I have to try to consume at night, I really want it to be good, usable information.
Yes. Good point. Representative Friedman.
Thank you. And just real quick, make sure that the report's electronic too. And that
yes.
can save all that
absolutely.
Printing. More
absolutely.
And more of the representatives are going to that.
And I think part of our intent, and I hope DHS hears that, is we want a report to the committee. This is so much more helpful than reading something that you fall asleep reading. So, yes, so please do come back. Any further discussion? Representative Cowan.
Madam Chair, we sincerely try to read those, but
yes.
our pending files are a little large, too.
Right.
And it is difficult not to fall asleep sometimes when we're reading, trying to get through our stuff late at night. I do think that this, I have come to the conclusion this would be useful information. And if it's done with the focus of helping us understand the functions of the agency and how that impacts the decision making, I think it needs to be carefully thought out in terms of the level of understanding of the readership and how that impacts the decisions that we're making, as opposed to a bunch of numbers that may not mean anything. So with that kind of a direction, I will look forward to that report. And I, too, will be visiting my self-sufficiency office on Monday. My biggest concern as I listen to the workers is I don't want my visit to make more work for individuals mm-hmm. who are trying to keep up with their workload. So I hope, because of the leadership I see in this room, that message will go out to the folks in our district offices that we're interested, we're trying to be there, but we don't want it to be any more difficult for them. So please help us stay out of the way and just learn something.
Right, yeah. And I would hope that an invitation, electronic invitation, will go to each representative in the building. We've mentioned it before publicly, and I think I mentioned it in the remonstrance time and also in our caucus, and I'm assuming that your caucus also, I hope your caucus has talked about it. But please do send an invitation to each legislator to visit their own DHS office. Representative Hoffman.
And Madam Chair, I have received one from
Great.
My local Gorge office. So I didn't know if others received that or not. Mm-hmm. And I must apologize. Because of my questions a couple of weeks ago on the wraparound, I ended up getting slotted in early to Center for Living office. So it's related, but it's not the TANF related because of my questions earlier.
Okay. Without further discussion, Zach, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Excuse?
Wasn't he testifying?
I think
he's
so.
Got
excuse.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Denbrook.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the majority, House Bill 2123 passes. And we need to assign a carrier. Does anyone have any great desire to carry this?
Is that not like a housekeeping bill?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's a simple bill.
It's just a report.
You
want to
carry it?
I mean, I'd carry it, but it seems like it could just
sure.
be a consent agenda.
Is
that something we can do consent?
Consent calendar? Sure.
Yeah,
okay,
let's
go on the consent calendar. All right. We close the work session on House Bill 2123, and we open up a work session on House Bill 2672 for the purpose of referring this bill to the House Revenue Committee. Am I doing it right?
That's correct.
All right.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2672 without recommendation to the House Committee on Revenue with a subsequent referral by prior reference to the Ways and Means.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2672 without recommendation to the House Committee on Revenue with a subsequent referral by prior reference to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, this motion passes and the measure is sent to the Committee on Revenue. Oh, I open up the work session on House Bill 2123 so that Representative Maurer can vote.
You have to ask for objections.
Oh, any objections? Thank you, Representative. Any objections? Seeing none. Representative Maurer, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative votes aye. Is that all you need to do? All right. We close the work session, House Bill 2123. Any other business, folks?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just have a quick thing. You'll notice it's going around. I will be personally bothering you every day through the month of April. Child Abuse Prevention Month. Our audience is gone now, but these tickets
are still being recorded.
I know.
The meeting is still open.
This event that's coming up will cap the month of Child Abuse Prevention Month in April.
Great.
So I have the tickets if anybody would care to have some.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Any other business for this committee?
That's been.
You're Olson. That's right. Okay, I will close the works. The House Committee on Human Services. Thank you all very much.